A lot of why we do the deals we do is my reaction to what I perceive to be stupid business traditions. Look them in the eye and you tell them up front, here's the good news, here's the bad news. Our last page is a list of all the quote unquote bad things, and it's just repeating what could piss them off 5 years later. And they have to initial it. Nobody has refused to sign it. We will tell them openly. Yeah. We had a comedian who went nuts, was like, you didn't say this, you didn't say that. Not only did we not say anything you're saying we said, not only is everything you're complaining about in the contract, you signed it. We shined a spotlight on this for you. We added this thing for extra moral protection.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out distrokid.com. What's going on? Welcome to the New Music Business. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, third edition coming very soon. Today, my guest is actually does not work in the music industry. And this is, I think, the first guest we've had that doesn't exclusively work in the music industry. He does work in the entertainment industry, specifically the comedy world. Now, I've always found some parallels between the comedy industry and the music industry, but don't turn it off. Even if you're not interested in the comedy industry, there are some incredible revelations here. I hope we have some record labels listening, because the way that Brian runs his record label, we can all learn a lot from in music. My guest today is Brian Volk Weiss, and he runs the most successful independent comedy record label in the world. It's the largest independent stand-up comedy production and distribution label, Comedy Dynamics. They work with some artists, just to name a few: Kevin Hart, Tiffany Haddish, Ali Wong, Jim Gaffigan, Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, Tom Segura. I could go on and on. It's essentially the who's who of comedy. It's everyone. I mean, Amy Schumer, Bo Burnham, I mean, just on and on and on. He is who you talk to when you are working in comedy and want to make a stand-up special. They have produced hundreds of stand-up specials and then turned those stand-up specials into albums. They have won 5 Grammys. The label, he started in 2017, mind you. It's a very new label. And in 2019, get this, every comedy album that was nominated for a Grammy was Brian's, was from Comedy Dynamics. That's pretty cool. I can't tell you a time in history when one record label had every nominee in the same category. So we talk about how to go about the Grammy nominating process, how his albums get nominated for Grammys, but more so how he got to where he's at, how he structures and runs his label. It's very fascinating. We talk about Prince a little bit and just the differences between major record contracts and Comedy Dynamics record contracts. Everyone is going to learn a lot, whether you care about comedy or not. This definitely listen to this episode. And if you're coming here from the comedy industry, welcome. Most of our episodes about the music industry, but likewise, how musicians and music industry professionals can learn a tremendous amount from the comedy industry. It goes both ways. And I know we have some comedians as listeners as well. So this one especially is for you. Speaking of which, please subscribe to the show. If this is your first time or you've been listening for a while, pause it right now. Hit that subscribe, hit that follow button if you want us to appear in your feed. And if you've been listening for a while and you'd love to leave us a review, a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts would be super helpful. That really helps. Very appreciated. I read the reviews for better or worse. But if you love the show, leave me a review. If you hate it, shoot me an email. My email's not hard to find. I'll get back to you. If you're listening on YouTube, leave a comment. I'd love to respond to the comments. And you can find us all that make the show happen on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Ari's Take. Find me on Instagram and Twitter at Ari Herstand. Visit ariestake.com. Get on the email list. That's where the most important information, we send it out regularly there. All right, let's kick into the show. Brian Volkweiss, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, Ari.
So for those of you who are just listening and don't have the magic of the visuals that I have right now, it seems that that you're a fan here, and if you could explain this fandom that I'm witnessing behind you, I'm going on this magical intergalactic journey right now. Discuss what I'm seeing behind you.
Yes. By the way, my favorite reaction to my background was Ian Mick. I'm sure I'm butchering this. Mick Diamond or something like that. He plays the Emperor in Star Wars. He saw my background. He goes, "Are you in a vegetable storage facility?" No, I am a toy collector. Okay. I have over 3,300 pieces, to put it nicely. My wife would say pieces of crap. Before COVID, this was my collection room. And since COVID, about now, thank God, it's only about 10% of the time. For whatever reason, today I'm working from my office at home. But yes, yeah. This is a tiny slice of my toy collection.
You're in just a general toy collector or a specific Star Wars toy collector?
So, like I said, there's about 3,300 pieces.
Yeah.
There it is. I would say Star Wars and Star Trek combined are half the collection.
Gotcha.
And then after those, it would be G.I. Joe. Then it would be Batman. And then I would say probably about a third of the collection is just random.
Amazing. Oh, my gosh. Well, I know there was a documentary out there that featured some of your toy collection. And so that's something that we can all take a look at if you want to learn more. But
the
we're not here today.
The toys that made us on Netflix.
The toys that made us. Yes, yes. Go check that out. All right, so we're not here today necessarily to talk about toys. And actually, I think of the near 100 guests that I've had on the New Music Business Podcast, I think you're the first one and only one that doesn't primarily work in the music industry. And I thought it was interesting to have you on the show because there are a lot of parallels with the comedy industry and the music industry. And I'm fascinated by the comedy industry. I love comedy. I get to as many shows as I can and I watch as many specials as I can. You know, as someone running the largest independent comedy label out there, you have an interesting perspective in kind of what it takes to put out releases. And I think there's a lot of parallels, specifically when it comes to the Grammys, which I know a lot of my audience is interested in, and kind of how you went about that process. But I want to kind of step back a little bit, and we'll get to the inception of Comedy Dynamic Records and all of that. But kind of just step me through how you broke into the comedy industry. I know you've done a lot of film work and TV work and producing and directing and all of that stuff. But for the most part, what led you to be the largest independent comedy label in the world?
It was as random as it gets. I moved out to LA. I mean, so much of this is cliched. Apologies in advance. I moved out to LA. I didn't know anybody. I worked every job except for camera department. I was a grip. I was an electric. I did everything. But that's a great way to burn through your life savings when you're 22, because I worked for free 99% of the time. Sure. So I was broke. But I also knew everything I'd been doing was on set. And I wanted to get earlier in the process. So, I mean, literally, I used to go to this breakfast club at 7 a.m. at the farmer's market, and some random guy. I mean, I didn't even know the guy. He was the friend of a friend of a friend. He came to one of the breakfasts, never saw him again. But at that breakfast, he introduced me to someone else who, long story short, got me an internship. And that internship down the hallway, because again, I wasn't getting paid. And I literally was trying to get a job as a waiter. I was out of money. And randomly, there was a guy down the hall, an assistant who was quitting, and his boss was a manager. Now, I didn't even know what a manager did. Like, sure. I had no idea. But all I knew, and this is all I needed to know when you're 22 years old, he was paying $50 a day cash to be an assistant. Sure. I interviewed. I got the gig. He only managed stand-up comedians. That's okay. It. And I, at that time in my life, had only been to a stand-up comedy club once. Mm-hmm. I did not enjoy it. I literally had like ducked out and missed three quarters of the show. Sure. The only comedian I remember was Todd Barry, who was great. Oh, yeah. And that Saturday, just to see what the company did, like I was just curious, like what is what does a management company do? I went to the Laugh Factory. I was given free tickets to the 7 o'clock show. I watched the show. I left, and because I didn't know anybody and I was brand new, I got on the line with 300 other people, paid for the 10 o'clock show. The 10 o'clock show ended. I got back on the line and I paid for the midnight show. And I literally watched like almost 7 hours of comedy on that first Saturday night. And I became obsessed with it. I mean, absolutely obsessed. I didn't know anything about anything. Like, the only special I'd ever seen was Eddie Murphy Raw.
Sure.
But like I would say within 6 months, I had probably seen 90%, which was easy to do back then. I had seen 90% of every stand-up special ever made. And then I became a manager. And I also only represented comedians.
Oh, wow.
And that's how it started.
Amazing. And what year are we talking here where you were on the line and you got your introduction?
1999.
Okay.
That was March of 99.
Nice. So you're a manager for comics for years. Now, tell me kind of, I'm assuming you're starting with comics that were kind of getting started as you're building your career. Well, these comedians are building their career.
I'm worried. I've already told you a long story. So if this next story is too long, please interrupt me.
Okay,
but by the way, if anybody wants to know how random management is, this is the best. I had a very, very, very unusual career.
Mm-hmm.
When I was still the assistant to the boss, the first new Star Wars movie was coming out in 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And there were these things a lot of people may not remember called line teams. Any line team, when a movie like Star Wars, because now it's normal for big things like this to come back. But back in 1999, nothing like this had ever happened. Mm-hmm. So you had to get on line teams and like wait weeks to get tickets. So obviously no one person is going to wait for weeks to get a ticket. So I was part of an 8-person line team. I would put in my 6-hour shifts every 4 days or whatever. I'm bad at math, every 2 days, whatever it was. And then one day, one of these young comedians I had never heard of in my life was a Star Wars fan, which again, in 2022, you're like, who gives a shit? Like everybody's a Star Wars fan. Yeah. It was a big deal to find a like-minded Star Wars fan.
Sure.
And he asked me, I know it's really not cool. And it was not cool. This was a big deal.
Yeah.
He asked me if I would get him a ticket. And I did. I remember I was only supposed to buy one. That's how it worked. Uh-huh. And I bought two. And that was because again, it's not fair to all the other people in line that if everybody did that, the people in line wouldn't be able to get tickets themselves.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, and I really thought about it, man, other people would say that they preyed on it. I mean, it really bothered me. But for some reason, and I'm the last person to normally break rules like this.
Mm-hmm.
I got the guy a ticket and we became great friends.
Mm.
And when I became a manager, because that story I just told you, I was the assistant.
Sure.
When I became a manager, he became one of my first clients. And I shared him, don't get me wrong, with the big boss.
Sure.
But at the time, this guy could barely sell 400 or 500 tickets. Cut to, about 2.5 years later, I mean, I'm not even 30. Like, yeah. I think I was like 26. He became the biggest comedian in 35 years. His name is Dane Cook.
Of course, he's at the top of the Laugh Factory. If you drive down Sunset Strip, his name is still right up top there. Incredible.
Exactly. And it has
the first one to sell out MSG, I think, Dane Cook.
Second
one to sell out.
Actually, third. Okay. It was Steve Martin, Andrew Dice Clay, and then Dane.
Dane Cook.
But what people don't understand is in 2022, it's like, well, who cares? Bill Burr, Glacius, Kevin Hart,
Sebastian,
Aziz.
Everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. So in 2022, there's probably between 15 and 20 comedians that can sell out MSG. Mm-hmm. When Dane did MSG, he was the third human being comedian ever to have done it. And not only that, I have to give Dane credit. He did it in the round, because when Dice and Steve Martin did it, it was not in the round. So Dane actually really did. Yeah. He really did sell it out.
Yeah. So you're managing Dane Cook. You've now become a manager. I'm assuming because he quickly becomes the largest comic in the world, that opens the door. Other comedians was like, well, I want to work with who Dane's working with. Man, his career's taken off. And so you're taking more meetings. Do you build out your roster or what happens then?
No, I wish that had happened. To be completely honest with you, if that had happened, there's a very good chance not only would I still be a manager, I'll be completely honest with you, I don't know if I would have built the company the way I did.
Okay.
Dane was a very controversial comedian.
Yeah.
And that is me being diplomatic. There's a better word I could use, but I'll stick with controversial.
Sure.
Because he was controversial, we did not, I mean, as a company, we actually not only did not receive a single incoming call because of Dane, we actually didn't get a lot of calls because of Dane.
Wow.
So like a lot of comedians didn't want to be at the company where Dane was represented.
Gotcha.
So what actually happened was because Dane blew up so quickly, and I mean like life-changing quickness in about 80 days.
Wow.
I mean, I went from being bonkers in debt, bonkers broke, worried about my car getting repossessed. Not a metaphor. That's real. Yeah. To like basically not having to worry about money over an 80-day period. So a lot of people go from broke to wealthy. It usually doesn't take 80 days.
Yeah. Right.
So that was the good news. The bad news was because Dane was such a big, and it wasn't really bad news, but because Dane was such a big business, I basically scaled back how many clients I had drastically and then went on the road with him. I mean, I was on every tour. I was on every movie. I was there every single day practically.
Sure.
So I went from having about 20 clients to having 4 clients over the course of about 3 months.
Mm. So when did you part ways? When did you stop working with Dane and stop managing clients?
So I stopped managing Dane and I retired. That for a manager, by the way, is like a gunslinger dying with his boots off. Like it's a big deal to be a manager retiring. Normally it's not a voluntary decision. But I retired from Dane, I believe, and as a manager, I think in 2011. If I'm wrong, it was 2010. I believe it was 2011.
And was there an impetus? Was there something that you're just like, you know what, management is no longer for me? Was the road life challenging? Was it just dealing, 24/7 having to be on call with your clients? Was it just like the lifestyle, or just did you lose interest in that line of work? Why did you decide to retire at what, 40, 35?
Well, then I didn't retire from show business. I just retired from management.
Listen,
I am not, other than being an actor, and I know this is ironic. But it probably leads to B. Other than being an actor, I am not aware of a worse job that exists than being a manager. And I can give you proof without using myself as an example.
Okay.
There is a manager. He is probably one of the most successful managers in history. Mm-hmm. I would say in a bad year, he makes $12 million. But I would say he probably makes around $20 million a year.
Wow.
I have never seen him. And he didn't say to me almost immediately how jealous he is that I've retired.
Wow.
So if you have the number one most successful, like imagine if Michael Jordan went around 24/7 complaining about how much he hates basketball.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what this guy is to management. So that being said, it's a horrible life. As I mentioned earlier, Dane was controversial. Which is not the exact right word to use here, but it's the word I will use.
Sure.
And to be honest with you, our other businesses, especially our stand-up comedy business, was maturing so quickly, and we had actually built up a really nice library that it just didn't make sense anymore to, you know, put myself out there like that. I realized I could make more money and have a better life just producing and building my company than I did managing four people.
Well, you know, that takes a lot of courage to go out and to stop doing something that you're familiar with and that you've proven that you can do, and to leave that behind and pivot and essentially start a new career. I mean, that I think, you know, we've been seeing in the Great Resignation and the Great Reset over the last couple of years, a lot of people doing that because they're prioritizing their happiness and their well-being and their quality of life over stability, I guess, immediate career stability, because they are choosing a different life that they want, and they want to structure their life in a way that is going to prioritize well-being and happiness, which I think is really crucial and important. So, you know, it worked out for you. But let's fast forward to 2017 when you launched Comedy Dynamic Records, because I want to get into this a bit as running a record label. Now, you know, most people listening to this are in the music industry, but I bet there's going to be some parallels here. What inspired you to launch the record label, and how did you do that?
Again, you know, it's funny. I always go out of my way to point out how random my career has been, because I get a lot of press about how I'm very smart and I'm a genius and I saw the future coming. And at least from my point of view, none of that is true. It's all been very random and very lucky. So, and again, don't get me wrong. I worked really hard, but I know lots of people who have worked hard and have not been able to do what they wanted to do. So it really is, a tremendous percentage of luck. But basically what happened was we started making stand-up specials for non-clients. So when I started making stand-up specials...
And who's we at this time?
Well, at the time, I was an employee, and the company was called New Wave.
Got it.
So, and the management company I worked for from 1999, a bigger company called New Wave bought my old boss's company in 2003.
Okay.
And then I, in 2017, bought the bigger company. So I was an employee there for like 15 years.
Got it.
So, what happened was I had just been making stand-up specials for my comedian clients, and I was making two or three a year. To be honest with you, sometimes one or zero. Mm-hmm. And one day I got a call from an agent, and the agent was like, "Hey, what do you think about doing a stand-up special for Michael Ian Black?" The guy's name was Michael Berkowitz. or Mike Berkowitz. I don't know why I just called him Michael. I have never called him Michael. It's Mike Berkowitz. So Mike Berkowitz called me about Michael Ian Black. That's why I called him Michael. And I got very angry. And the first question I asked is, does Michael need a manager? And he's like, no, he's been with the same manager for 20 years. He's fine. And I'm like, and I got angry. I was like, dude, I'm not here to just fucking make people stand up specials. Come on. Like, call me when he needs a manager.
Yeah.
The next day in the shower, I was like, you know what? I'm pretty sure my job is to make money as long as it's legal. So I called him back. I apologized. And that was our first stand-up special that we made. It's the first time the company ever did anything, not with a client. So that is Exhibit A. You might be wondering, when am I going to answer your question? Here it comes. So Exhibit B, again, sort of lucky, but through Dane, I had, of course, become friends with the guy who ran Comedy Central Records, a guy named Jack Vaughn, who right now is running all of comedy for Sirius. And even though I had produced albums with Dane and other comedians for Jack, and Jack had given other clients of mine record deals, it was only when we started producing our own album, our own stand-up specials, Jack had said to me, I'm just curious, you're making all these specials, you own them. Why aren't you putting out albums? So because he was my friend and because it wasn't a lot of work, we started just giving him the albums and he put them on Comedy Central and everything was great.
Yeah.
And then one day after I read a book called The Long Tail, and that book, which I read in 2006, that book is what inspired me to do everything I've done. I basically asked Jack if he thought we could launch our own record label. And he very nicely, because again, this would be in competition with Comedy Central. He very nicely said, he's like, listen, if I am being honest with you, it's kind of stupid you don't have one. And that's when we launched our record album. And I'll be completely honest with you. The day we launched, dude, maybe the first 6 months we launched, I didn't understand. I didn't get it. I didn't know what Sound Exchange was. I didn't understand. Like, I didn't get it. Like, to me, audio was like the icing on the cake. And I wouldn't go so far as today to say that audio is the cake. It absolutely is not. But I would say that audio is half the cake and half the icing.
And in the comedy industry, you're saying the other half is the stand-up specials, the live performance and all of that?
Yes, because the same way we're a record label distributing records, we're also a video distributor. So we distribute the video to hundreds of places every day. And then we also do a lot of license deals too. So we'll license, like, you know, we did Ali Wong's first stand-up special on Spec. We're one of the only companies that regularly, like we do before COVID, we did 20 to 30 Spec specials a year.
And what this is that? Does that mean that you produce it without a network attached from the get-go?
We finance it. Yes.
Got it.
So we, so using Ali as the example, like we did her special on Spec and then we licensed it to Netflix. So that was not originally a Netflix special. Same thing with Tom Segura. Same thing with Tiffany Haddish with Showtime. So like if you see Tiffany Haddish's first special on Pluto or Roku or Samsung or Peacock today, that's ours. Like that's not Showtime's. So the audio was always like, whatever. But eventually it became pretty apparent. It is not a whatever.
And so now when you're doing deals or producing stand-up specials or even negotiating a stand-up special, is it always tied to the audio rights as well? Whereas before, were you just ignoring the audio rights and those capacities?
We always got the rights. Don't get me wrong.
You just didn't exploit it.
No, we did. But I guess what I would say is we didn't do it in a systematic way. So, you know, and then the other thing I should mention is, like I said, I read that book. That book, like before I read The Long Tail, we were making, I would say, between 3 and 5 specials a year.
Right.
After I read the book, I think the first full 12 months after I read the book, we made 15 specials. And then, and like I said, I read the book in 06. And in 2019, the last full year before COVID, I mean, we made 32 specials. So what that did was that gave us the volume to actually be a label. But on top of that, to further answer your question, on top of that, I mean, we also started very aggressively producing album only deals and then also acquiring specials. So we make, I mean, I would say a quarter of our releases on the audio, on the record division side, a quarter of our albums are album only.
So that's interesting. I didn't actually realize there were any comedy album only records. I thought they all came from specials. So, so now is your approach when you do a special? It's systematic. It automatically the album is released like the same day.
Yeah, okay. We've done I think about 240 specials. I would say, at the most, 5, we didn't have the audio rights. And the reason for that is they had pre-existing deals and I wanted the video so badly, I agreed to do it. But, and by the way, I'm telling you 5 to be safe.
I think
the real number is 2 or 3.
So when you said that audio is about 50% of the business, now break that down a little bit. Are we talking streaming royalties from Spotify, Apple Music? Is this where the money is coming from? And Sound Exchange, you mentioned a little bit of that. I mean, where's the money coming from, really?
The majority, the vast majority of the money is digital. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's Apple, it's iTunes, Amazon, what have you.
Sure.
And then, of course, Sound Exchange.
And explain Sound Exchange a little bit, because on the music side, you know, we're familiar with Sound Exchange that pays the record labels and the featured artists, the actual artists, not the songwriters, which we can get into a little bit later, but it's the artists themselves, the featured performers, what they call it on Sound Exchange. And it's typically for digital radio, which I'm assuming, you know, like Pandora, Sirius XM. Is that big business for comedy? Is there the comedy specials being played on Pandora, Sirius XM, iHeart, those digital radio stations? That's why there's a significant money amount coming to comedy? Real quick, I want to let you know about Too Lost. Too Lost is a new distribution company to the space. And let me tell you, I am very impressed with them. I got a full deep dive demo with the founder, and yeah, they're very innovative. And when you come into the distribution space at this stage with how crowded it is, you better be innovative, and they are. Yes, they will get your music out to Spotify, Apple Music, all the places, plus 450 other outlets around the world. They do not take a commission. This is why 300,000 artists and labels have already used them. They've already distributed 7 million songs. They offer payment splitting, and they don't charge your collaborators for this service for the payment splitting. They will just pay your collaborators directly for free. They have publishing administration with BMG, so you know it's legit. A lot of distributors have fallen into trouble with using some other less than legit pub admin services. Well, Too Lost is partnered with BMG. You know it's legit. They offer instant royalty advances. This is something that's very cool. And if you have historical streaming data and you need just a bulk payment up front, they can see how much your music has earned in the past. I'm like, all right, we think we know what you're going to earn in the next 3 years. Here's a check for $100,000 or whatever it will be. And you can just click a button and you get that distributed and into your account immediately. They do lyrics and credits distribution for free. They have a very innovative analytics platform where, yes, you will see real-time analytics for Spotify, Apple Music, but also Pandora, Deezer, SoundCloud, and Peloton. They're the only ones that do Peloton. They also have a service where you can search the internet wherever your music is being used, and it will just show you a chart of everywhere. Every TikTok video, everywhere, every YouTube video, everywhere your music is possibly being used. I've never seen this before. That was very cool. They'll register you with SoundExchange, and they have a fraud prevention tool, and they're doing fraud prevention. So if you're worried about your music, you know, getting a bot attack or something like that and getting ripped down, which we've seen is a big issue, they have fraud prevention tools that are better than most other distributors that I have seen. Check out TooLost. You can just go to TooLost.com, use the promo code ARIESTAKE for 3 months free and try them out. Let them know what you think.
On Sirius alone, there are 6 comedy channels.
Oh, wow.
Like,
okay.
Pandora has, I believe, 2. I mean, it's a huge business. Huge and, cool. And growing,
yeah,
fast.
Cool. That's great to hear. I wasn't familiar with that. Now, what is now when it comes to, you're an independent record label and you've been nominated. You've won I guess 5 Grammys, nominated for a bunch of Grammys. I think I read in 2019 you had, was it every album that was nominated for a Grammy that year or something like that? Send me through the process of how you go about getting nominated for a Grammy.
Dude, it's so complicated. I don't even know if you'll understand it, but I'll
hit me.
I will talk.
Try it.
I will talk slowly. I will talk slowly for your benefit.
Thank you.
We submit a list, and then they tell us what got in.
So, right. Well, let's get a little bit more detail with that. So you submit a list to whom? And how?
We send a list to the Grammy Association of every album we put out.
Okay.
Then that list gets turned. They then turn it into, somehow on their own, turn it into a shorter list. Mm-hmm. Then that shorter list, because again, we put out about 150 albums a year, more than that actually. Mm. So it then gets reduced to, let's say, 20 albums.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I'm sure there's an answer as to how they do that. I just don't know it.
Sure.
Then those 20 albums, the Grammy sends a giant email form to all voting members.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are on the form. Whoever gets the most votes gets a nomination.
Mm-hmm.
And then whoever gets a nomination, whoever gets the most votes wins.
So, right, it's the Recording Academy, and yes, there are a few rounds of voting where it's like, I've seen the list of the first round, which is endless, and I mean, I guess it helps because a lot of the albums that you have, I mean, a lot of these are from recognizable names. I mean, we're talking, you know, Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock and Patton Oswalt, Jim Gaffigan, and on. So that probably makes it a little bit easier. These are recognizable names. Now, how did you develop the catalog to this extent? Was it just from acquiring the rights from Comedy Central Records, and that's how you initially grew the catalog? Or was it, I think I read somewhere that you actually are now the distributor for Comedy Central Records, but prior to that deal, when you were just having, you know, your own catalog and your own releases without Comedy Central's catalog, where were you obtaining these rights from? Were these comedians striking deals directly with you, signing record deals directly with you, these production deals, or was it working alongside studios that had existing deals? Kind of step me through the nuances of where all these rights came from.
Yeah. I mean, if we're only talking about the Grammys, I mean, Comedy Central was not relevant at all. I mean, we just started distributing Comedy Central this January of 2022. Okay. And we just got their back catalog. So all of our nominations and all of our wins came about in one of two ways. The first is we produced the album based on a special or something like that. Like, we made it ourselves from scratch.
Yep.
And then we distributed it and it got a nomination.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes won. That's half of it. The other half is somebody else made a special. Mm-hmm. And they needed a record label to produce the record. And we produced the record for them, even though we didn't produce the special. That's what happened with Chris, with Chappelle and Louis.
Okay. Gotcha. So breakdown, I'm very curious. I don't know really the comedy industry in the inner workings. I know the music industry very well, but I'm curious how record deals work in the comedy industry. Is it per special? Is it just you're signing a one album deal? Do you have options of additional albums that are in there? What's the royalty breakdown? Where's the ownership fall? How does this all work? Break down a typical record deal, a deal for comedy.
I'm going to do my best to answer all your questions, but I have a horrible memory. So if I forget one, apologies.
Sure.
And it goes without saying, I can only tell you about our deals.
Okay.
I either don't know how other companies don't work or it's not my place to say how they do.
Sure.
But if I'm just speaking for us.
Yeah.
Can you ask them one at a time?
Yes, let's go one at a time.
Thank you. Make the scene.
Okay. So number one, how many album deals do you work with? So is it a one album deal?
Yes.
Multiple
so
album?
This,
how does that work?
So I'm so glad you asked this. A lot of how I run the company is based on my experiences as a manager.
Okay.
So there are things that I do that are kind of weird in some ways, but I believe in the long run actually will make more money.
Okay.
You could not have asked a better question to make my point. We absolutely, positively do not, as a rule, even ask for options. I do not want to work with any artist that doesn't want to work with us. I want it to be something they choose to do and something they are not obligated to do.
Mm.
The reason is, when I was a manager, the anger that my clients would have when they went from being a nobody to a somebody and then being obligated to perform within a crappy deal. A, life's too short. I don't want to deal with that bullshit. Two, I'm allowed to curse, right?
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
And then probably should have asked that a while ago.
You're good.
And then two, I don't want to work with a comedian that doesn't want to work with me. You know, that's just going to be like, we have enough money. We have enough success.
Mm.
So to force a comedian to work with us, it's not fair. I guarantee you 90% of our deals, we could get the comedians to agree to at least a plus one.
Sure.
We have never asked. I never will ask. And I guarantee you, the first time there's a CEO of the company that's not me, that will be one of the first things they change about our deals. But I'm not going to change it. So no, we've never done a plus one, let alone a plus four.
I love that. And that, I mean, artists love that and love you for that. And you know, we talk about all the time that artists that are struggling with their labels and they feel bound to it. I mean, Prince said, major labels are like slavery. I would encourage every artist not to sign a major label. On the music side, it's well documented that artists don't appreciate those draconian deals that lock them in for sometimes 10 albums sometimes that could be 20 years, 30, you know, it's craziness. So that's great to hear. Question number two about how the deals are structured. Is there an advance versus royalties? Is it a recoupable? And then what's the royalty split?
So we have over 2,000 albums.
Okay.
I think we have one record where the artist doesn't get back end.
Okay, one. So it was purchased outright. You owned the rights.
No, there was a lawsuit.
Oh, just kidding.
But that was part of the settlement.
Okay, got it.
So, but my point was the other 1,999, everybody gets
got it
back end.
Okay.
80% of the time we pay, 75% of the time we provide an advance. 25% of the time it's just rev share.
Okay. And what are we talking?
We never ever go below 30%.
And again, on which side?
On our side. Meaning my company never takes less than 30%.
Okay.
And again, I guarantee you there's some deals I'm forgetting about, but 99.99999% of our deals, we never go below 30%. And we never go above, I think, 70%. And I would say that less than 0.1% of our deals are at even 70%. If we're getting 70%, that means I really don't want the album.
Yeah.
But I'm doing a favor to somebody. But I would say 60 to 70% of our deals are 50-50.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, that's a, yeah, right. That's quite a fluctuation from 30 to 70%. But 50-50, that makes sense that that's the majority.
If I can address that for a second, sure. And this goes back to what I was saying before,
sure.
Where a lot of what I learned as a manager, I use now while we're running, you know, the company. I do not believe in this situation, in the topic we're discussing.
Yes.
I don't care about precedent. Like, I feel like business in general, especially Hollywood, is obsessed with precedent. And it's stupid because, maybe not stupid, but it's short-sighted because you are talking about artists. There's no profession in the world except for maybe astronauts where, like, one shoe fits all, like, or one size fits all. Like, right. Every deal is different. By the way, dude, I've done deals with the same comedian where in 2015, he or she got fucking 80%, or not 80%. Mm-hmm. Let's say got 30. Let's say in 2015, a comedian got 70%.
Uh-huh.
And then I did another deal with them in 2017 where they got 30%.
Oh, wow.
And you would say, well, why did it go down?
Yeah.
Well, maybe they were going through a divorce and the advance was tripled.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they had cooled off and I didn't want to do a deal for another album. And they wanted it so badly, they said, name your price. And normally I wouldn't do that. Because again, I just want everybody to be happy. I don't want, I always, again, and this is because I was a manager. The Comedy Cellar in New York at 3 a.m, you do not want those comedians sitting there having crappy cheese sticks and nachos. The food there is actually very good, but at 3 a.m, you know, whatever. But you don't, now I'm going to get a call from Noam. The food's great. I love the food. You don't want these comedians at 3 a.m. sitting around a table saying how your company sucks and you're stealing money or you're, Your the Prince quote about slavery and all that stuff. Like, we lose money when those conversations happen. There are comedians out there that hate my guts as a human being. They hate me. But I have heard many times in those 3 a.m. conversations where a comedian, a very respected comedian, will say, I hate Brian. He's a horrible person, but they're honest, they're fair, they pay on time. And even though I hate Brian, you can trust him. And like, I hate that I'm saying this because I hate Brian, but he'll take good care of you. So that's why I have a lot of these rules, because it may seem like we're losing money in that day or that week or that year. But in the long term, that 3 a.m. chatting, if it's positive, it will make more money over the lifetime of the label.
I love that. And that's the opposite of how it goes in the music industry, where they're usually like, I love my A&R. I love the people at the label, but they're unethical and their contract's confusing. And not only that, but they are predatory, and they got me to sign away all my rights and my firstborn child, but man, are they nice people. So, you know, I think we'd all prefer the former of, they might not like someone as a person, but as long as they're ethical and do good business, that's what we can hope for when we're engaging in business relationships and business partnerships, because that's what it is.
Exactly.
Getting back to the deal, break down the royalties a little bit more. So is it, if you give somebody, let's just say, I'm throwing out random numbers, I have no concept of ballpark in the comedy industry, but let's just say you give somebody $100,000 advance and it's a 50-50 deal. Does it work like the music industry where you need to make essentially $200,000 gross before you start paying the 50-50 split? Is that how it works?
No, not for us.
Okay. How does it work?
And just to, again, I can tell you like specifics, which, and I do too. We have paid $500 advances.
Mm-hmm.
Our biggest advance we've ever paid was $7.5 million. Wow. So it literally fluctuates between $500 and $7.5.
Okay.
So just again, give you a sense of scale.
Sure.
So, it's not 2x. I would say if our all in number to make the advance, produce the album and or special, let's just take a safe number because I'm bad at math.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that cost us $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
The artist would start seeing back end at about $112.
I don't understand. So
sorry. I forgot that I said 1,000.
Yeah.
wait, hold on. At $1,112.
I got it. Okay, so you make back $1,000.
There's basically a 10% distribution fee on our deals, which is what, you know, that's the money we use to actually do what we do.
Sure.
So once that is caught, so that's what I'm saying. Like, without that, it would be dollar for dollar. So the minute we're in the black, the profit starts.
So my question, and maybe this it doesn't work this way. In music, the reason why I said $200,000 for a $100,000 advance was because the artist, they only get to pay down their account based on their royalty amount. So if their royalty amount is 50%, and let's say I'm the artist and you give me $100,000. If we make $100,000 gross, I've only paid down my royalty account $50,000. So I still have, you know, another $100,000 to go that we split 50-50 before I start earning on that. So it essentially $200,000 needs to come in for me to start earning another dollar after you paid me $100,000. Does that make sense? Does that work that way? Or are you paying from dollar one?
Yes. It's funny, the video and the audio are slightly different in this regard. And again, to be completely blunt with you, if you had asked me this 5 years ago, I could give you an answer like that with all the details.
Sure.
This topic I'm a little hazy on, but like I said, it's not dollar for dollar.
Yeah.
But it's also not. What you just said is a much more extreme version of what we do.
Okay. Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. It's and it's similar in music where licensing, sync licensing, you know, for film and TV, it's the licensing side is very different from quote unquote the sales side, which is now streams, but essentially you get paid from whatever money comes in. They split that from dollar one on the video side, where
it's not first dollar in audio, like it's not Tom Cruise with a Top Gun 2.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's as much as possible our costs get covered. Sure. And then the back end starts, and again,
Got it.
And I just want to be clear, like, I'm not sitting here saying, like, I'm some altruistic, like, artsy fartsy, I want love and kumbaya and all that. Yeah. It really does come down to, when I was a manager, I saw how dumb a lot of the deals were and how they were designed to piss off the artist in yeah. success. So a lot of why we do the deals we do is my reaction to what I perceive to be stupid business traditions. That's number one. But number two, like, I really think people, and artists in particular, if you look them in the eye and you tell them up front, here's the good news, here's the bad news. You're a grown-up. Remember that you are a grown-up. And when you take that pen and you sign that contract,
yeah,
it means you're cool with the bad news. I'll tell you something crazy. I am so anal about this topic about communicating effectively bad news up front because I am so concerned with that 3 a.m. Chatter at the at the cellar. By the way, it's not just the cellar, it's, you know, the comedy store in LA. In our contracts at the back, there is a literally every my lawyers everybody thought I was insane to do this. My lawyers told me nobody's going to sign this, Brian. Nobody has even questioned it. Our last page is a list of all the quote unquote bad things in the deal for the artist. And it's just repeating what could piss them off 5 years later. And it literally says, you understand, blah, 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 blah. And they have to initial it. So every contract, they sign the contract and then they have to initial, I think it's eight things. And those eight things literally are all the bad stuff that they could be mad about later. And oh, like gosh. I said, everybody told me I was nuts and nobody, first of all, nobody has refused to sign it. A couple lawyers maybe every now and then are like, what the fuck is this? He's signing a contract. Like, why do you need that? And we will tell them openly. And by the way, why do you think we do this? We had a comedian who went nuts. And like, was like, you didn't say this, you didn't say that, and blah, blah, blah. And was saying all this bullshit at one of those 3 a.m. conversations. And I'm like, not only did we not say anything you're saying we said, not only is everything you're complaining about in the contract, you signed it. So we added this thing for extra, for lack of a better expression, moral protection.
Oh my God.
So that if anyone complains, we can say, you initialed, we shine a spotlight on this for you.
Ugh, what a novel concept. I mean, that's the thing. In all the record contracts that I've seen, you know, especially the major record contracts that are 100 pages long, they're essentially trying to fool you, trick you, and confuse you into signing their terms and to hide all the bad stuff on page 73 and that you just won't find or your lawyer will miss. And then they make the same arguments. It's like, well, you signed the contract. It's I didn't have a gun to your head when you signed the contract. And every artist is just like, it was 100 pages of legalese. You expect me to understand that and to read that? And like, okay, my attorney missed it because they were sleep deprived and had 7 other clients and I was a low priority. And this was my first record contract that I signed when I was 18. And you're saying it's my fault 15 years later that I'm stuck to you because like you hid all these things that I didn't know about, my lawyer didn't know about and missed and all that stuff. That shit happens all the time. And that's why all these lawsuits are flying around in the music industry. And that's like, I hope every person who runs the label in the industry right now, the music industry right now, listens to Brian and takes this. That would be brilliant. I want to see at the back of a record contract all the bad stuff. That's fantastic. If there's one thing to take away from that, every record contract in the future needs to have all the bad stuff on the final page. I fucking love that. That's
by the way, if you like that, you're gonna love this. Our contracts, I mean, they're 8 or 9 pages long.
As they should be.
Yeah. Like, and by the way, I say this all the time. I say this privately all the time. I've said it publicly, and I mean this. And by the way, again, I'm saying this to you from experience.
Yes.
I didn't wake up and have this like altruistic opinion. The worst thing anybody can ever say to me when we're going to try and get a deal done, the worst thing, I'm not using a lawyer. Anytime someone says they're not using a lawyer, I'm like, that is a super duper bad idea.
Right.
Go find a lawyer. Yep. This is not a good idea, but it's better than not using a lawyer. I will give you a list. Here's five lawyers who I trust. You should not hire a lawyer, I'm recommending, but it is better for you to have one of them do it than no lawyer.
Yeah.
And I would say 85% of the time I can convince them to hire a lawyer. 20% of the time it's one of the lawyers I recommend. 80% of that group, they find their own lawyer.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You need, this shit's complicated, man.
Yeah, and as you should. I mean, no artist should use a lawyer necessarily recommended by the party that they are negotiating with. But yeah. I appreciate the intention, and I understand that, you know, you're trying to have your artists protect themselves and educate them to protect themselves, which they definitely need to and should. And yes, don't try to negotiate a contract without a lawyer. That's just kind of business.
And by the way,
but yeah,
if they do use one of our recommended lawyers, the artist needs to not only sign a letter to the lawyer that they're okay with the conflict of interest.
Right.
We add a paragraph or something or a section to our deals, also making them initial that.
Yeah.
Like that. Cause again, it's like you look at, you brought up Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Like how much money was lost by the label? Their lives were probably shortened. All those weekend and Thanksgiving calls while this artist who will be celebrated till the end of our civilization changes his name to a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Give the guy some more fucking money.
Right.
Like you have, like I always wonder, like maybe because I come from like a real low middle class upbringing and because I made like 12 grand my first year in LA kind of stuff, like, you don't need every dime. Like, you just don't. And you will make more money if there's good word of mouth.
Mm.
So why are you fucking with Prince?
Like, or any artist, to be honest.
Prince, 90% of every dollar that comes in of the profit, having him on your label
will
generate so much more money for your other records. It gives you power. When you're negotiating with Sirius, it gives you like, give the guy, it's his songs.
Right.
Like, I understand if some guy comes up to you, you've never heard of, and you got to spend millions of dollars to turn him or her into a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. The label, the studio, they deserve to make a boatload of cash for that risk. But if you're working with someone who's already famous, already successful, give them the lion's share of the money. Like, redo the contract, tear it up. I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that it's great because sometimes you need an outside perspective, someone who outside the music industry, who also, you know, you said don't care so much about precedent and has seen it from the other side, seen it from the management side, seen it from on the other side of the table. What artists go through and those 3M conversations are like to actually make the change that's necessary and ethical, frankly. I think a lot of these deals are quite unethical on the major label level. Still to this date, you know, hopefully things are starting to change a bit. So Brian, what are you focusing on these days? What are you working on? What's kind of the next steps?
So, you know, again, we're kind of a little bit of a weird company, but the stand-up comedy act, well, it started with management.
Mm-hmm.
Then we built the audio and video distribution systems for the stand-up. We have taken that money and started doing documentaries and scripted shows. And then you know, over the hopefully the next 1 to 3 years, we'll be making our second feature, then our third and fourth feature, all scripted. Cool. And then do the same thing with scripted TV shows. Nice. So we now own the, so we're basically now doing in documentary series what we did in stand-up comedy 12 years ago. So 5 years ago, 99% of our production work for television was work for hire, where we made a show, gave it to Netflix or gave it to History Channel or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then we never made another dime and they controlled it. Mm-hmm. Now about 60% of our documentaries we own and we control and we just license the way we used to do it with stand-up specials. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're basically, I came out here to build a studio. Like most people come out here to be a director, a writer, an actor. I came out to build a studio from scratch, obviously, because I did not own one when I got here. So it would have to be by scratch or from scratch. So that's, we're just moving up the value chain and making bigger and bigger things because we can afford to make things now that we could not have afforded to make 3 years ago. Sure. But if you can allow me to make a shameless plug for a second, I get asked now incessantly, are we going to stop making stand-up comedy? No, never. As long as I'm in charge, and I'll be in charge until I retire or sell the company, and I don't think I'll ever sell the company. So for at least another 15 to 20 years, we will be making stand-up comedy at scale.
Amazing. And I'm sure every comedian listening, it just took a sigh of relief as well, because this is, it's very appreciated in the artist world, this model that you have. Well, Brian, this has been an incredibly fascinating conversation. I'm so happy that we got to chat, and I'm happy that you are the first person outside the music industry that I had on the show, because you shined a really great light on what could be and how things could work in the music industry, because it's working for you in the comedy industry, and it could work across the board in this ethical way. I have one final question that I ask everybody on the show. Now I'm gonna adjust it slightly for you, but what does it mean to make it in the entertainment industry?
For me, our library provides enough money to make new content without having to go sell things. The amount of money the amount of time I have spent in my career, and I do as recently as this morning when I pitched a show on selling things, is staggering. Mm-hmm. So to be able to never have to sell again and just greenlight that, and we're getting close. I mean, on stand-up comedy, we don't sell anymore. I mean, we practically, the only reason we do work for hire anymore is because it's a relationship. Like Jim Gaffigan, we've produced his last 7 specials. We're producing his 8th special in later this year. It's not a lot of profit.
Sure.
But it would break my heart if somebody else was making a Jim Gaffigan special. So other than people like Jim Gaffigan or Tom Papa or just people that we've worked with for a long time, I mean, we really are only making stuff now that we're self-financing and we can distribute.
Amazing. Brian Volk-Weiss, thank you so much. That was great.
Thank you. A lot of fun, man. Great question.
Thank you.
Bye.
Today's episode was edited by Maxton Hunter, theme music by Brassroots District, and produced by all the great people at Ari's Take. This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over 1 million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out, and DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out distrokid.com.